You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. Denise Dixon from the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now spoke recently in Chicago about the possible impact of war, particularly in regards to African Americans.
Black folks been fighting for this country's freedoms before they were free. We understand. We understand that freedom comes at a price. But this war is not about anybody's freedom. This war will not make Americans free. This war will not make Iraq people free. This war will only kill our sons and daughters. During the Vietnam War, when black males made up 20% of the casualties, black folks in communities, white folks in communities stood up and said, "That's too many." President Johnson then ordered that the black folks that were in the military be cut back some on going on the front line. We don't have a President Johnson this time. We got Bush. He ain't cutting back nothing for nobody. According to the study by the Academy Community of International Securities, I got this off the web if anybody wants to see it, this war is estimated to cost between $99 billion to $1.9 trillion. Now, we got to pay for the war because our gas bills are going to go up, the gas in our cars is going to go up, everything else is going to be inflationary, and then we got to send our kids to die, too? That's too much. I say let's ask Bush to send his daughters first. Because they are babies. And then I'll think about sending mine. Even though this morning she got up at 6 o'clock, headed to the unit to get her shot. So it's coming. We cannot think that it's not coming because he's trying to ramrod this thing through. And if we don't stand up, we cannot afford to sit back and wait for somebody else to speak for us. We have to speak for ourselves or we are doomed. Right now, the total population of black males age 18 to 24 in the United States is 14%. But in the military, they're 20%. Our children are being targeted. We cannot afford to be quiet. There are twice as many black folks in the military than in the total population today. But only 8% of those are officers. There's only 8% of those that are officers. So the rest are enlisted, which means they hit the ground first, which means they get the bullet first. We have to say no. We also know that they are targeting males from the South, from the poor areas, from communities that are not affluent. Those are the kids that are not in school. They are asking them to come and join up and we can give you money for school. That's a lie. They're only going to give them a certain amount and then they have to jump through all kinds of hoops and some of them got fire on them in order for them to get that money. So do not encourage your children right now to go to war. It's ridiculous. It makes no sense. I am not unpatriotic. My father served in the Navy in World War II. My husband served in Korea. My daughter is getting ready to go over there now. But this war makes no sense. This is not a war for anybody's freedom. In Desert Storm, blacks made up 22.2% and only 6% were officers. This is ridiculous. As I said before, we have to say no.
Denise Dixon from the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now speaking in Chicago. Thanks to Wayne Hambach at Labor Express for that piece. Oil executives from around the world are in Istanbul this week for talks with the Turkish government and the governments of oil-rich Central Asian countries. The main topic for discussion is Turkey's role as a conduit for oil pipelines. But as Aaron Glantz reports from Istanbul, the real prize for the oil executives is just a few miles southeast in Iraq.
Turkish Energy Minister Hilmi Güler stands in front of a crowd of oil executives and foreign dignitaries at Shirvan Palace on the Bosphorus Straits in Istanbul. It's his first major speech since his Islamic AKP party took power in Turkey last month, and he's listing off the staggering number of oil and gas pipelines his government plans to build to ensure an easy flow of oil from Central Asia to the United States and Europe. There's the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline that will bring oil from Georgia and Azerbaijan to Europe and the United States. There's a pipeline that will bring oil from Kazakhstan to the West, and one for Turkmenistan as well. There's another oil pipeline for Kyrgyzstan, he says, and one that will take oil from Romania and the former Yugoslavia, making Turkey the hub for oil bound for the United States. The Bush administration is pushing these pipelines hard. If they don't get built, the oil will have to be transferred through Russia, Iran, or China to get to the sea, meaning U.S. oil companies won't have complete control. But more than the pipelines, U.S. companies and the Bush administration are salivating over Iraq's oil. Iraq has the second largest store of oil reserves in the world, trailing only Saudi Arabia, and the only thing that stands in George Bush's way is Saddam Hussein. Metin Kordan Demesur is Istanbul correspondent for The Banker and The International Investor.
Iraq is right in the Gulf area, basically. It's not remote like the oil producers in Central Asia, in the Caspian region. To bring the oil to international markets, you have to build 1,000-mile pipelines, and often through hostile areas like Chechnya or through the Kurdish areas of Turkey. And this is, it's easier to get the Iraqi oil out to international markets if you have pro-Western regime there.
American oil companies already have an easy way to get oil out of the country and into American hands if Saddam is forced from power. There's a 70-million-ton oil pipeline that runs from the Kurdish oil fields of northern Iraq out to Turkey. It was built after the CIA engineered a coup to topple Iraq's then-president Abdul Karim Qassam. That was when the U.S. installed Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party to ensure the continued flow of oil.
It has a capacity to pump 70 million tons of crude oil, Iraqi crude oil, each year from northern Iraq to a Turkish Mediterranean oil terminal, from where it is shipped.
Shipped through the Mediterranean to oil refineries in Europe and the United States. There's not much shipping from that Turkish port now. The oil flow from Iraq has all but dried up since the United Nations imposed sanctions on the country after the first Gulf War in 1991. İsim Asedim is an industrial chemist and a researcher from Petrolish, Turkey's oil workers' union. She estimates Turkish workers have lost $150 million a year as a result of the oil embargo. The Petrol Workers Union's membership has shrunk by half since the Gulf War in 1991, from 70,000 members to just over 35,000.
Batı bölgelerine göre geri durumda idi.
The economy was destroyed there. The destruction of the economy destroyed the people's happiness. The only trade income was the oil trade, and they lost both the border trade and the oil trade. We cannot sell goods or buy goods, and they were selling many things before. The troubles that come from the economy, health problems and poverty, are worse and worse than they used to be.
But despite those economic losses, Asedim says the Turkish petrol workers still oppose the war on Iraq, and she has a message for the American people.
I believe the American people have the sense not to enter into something that they will never be able to account for in the future. I believe they have the total sense not to enter into this war and make their government cancel it. I believe that they have the power.
The Turkish people, Asedim says, are depending on the American people to stop the war in Iraq. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Istanbul with Khalid Sidmohand.
In South Africa, the U.S. has enjoyed widespread support, but there's a growing sentiment against U.S. involvement in the Middle East. On a number of occasions, the U.S. consulate or embassy has reportedly been closed due to security alerts. To date, the demonstrations against the U.S. war in Iraq have been peaceful. But Kenneth Walker, executive producer of Earth Rights, a new television show to be produced in Johannesburg, warns that the U.S. installations all over Africa and South Africa in particular are very vulnerable to attacks if the U.S. goes to war. Walker says the Bush administration policy has changed public opinion toward the U.S.
I've been traveling to Africa generally and South Africa in particular for more than 20 years, and the identification of South Africans across the board with Americans and American culture has perhaps been unique in the world. And for the first time, I'm seeing a sharp reduction in that admiration and identification, and I think that in Africa generally and in South Africa that the United States' position, not so much against in the war against terrorism, but its progeny, this apparent imminent war against Iraq, it's playing very badly.
So when you say not so much against the U.S.'s so-called war against terrorism, does that mean that that the residents of Johannesburg or South Africa in general are accepting of that on the basis of that concept? Or
no, in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, the attacks in New York and the Pentagon, there was a great sympathy, I think, an understanding that that this had to be countered, and I think initial support for the U.S. effort to do it. I think the U.S. Manner of waging war in Afghanistan began to diminish that support pretty rapidly, and it virtually evaporated with this new take by the present administration against Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, former South African President Nelson Mandela has been quite critical about the Bush administration.
That's a good way to measure the change. You may recall shortly after September 11th, before the war in Afghanistan began, President Mandela came, met at the White House with President Bush, and backed him on the White House lawn rather forcefully. And here recently, in the last few months, with the U.S. campaign against Iraq, President Mandela has described the United States as a threat to world peace.
Is the average South African discussing this impending war against Iraq? I mean, if you go in the grocery stores or if you go in the pubs or the coffee houses.
Well, it certainly is. It receives prominent attention in the South African press. And I think certainly among the South African intelligentsia, it is discussed a lot. Now, most average so-called South Africans have far more pressing concerns about food and shelter and health care for this to be a daily pressing thing. But it is talked about. It is something the intelligentsia discusses, and they're quite anxious about.
Now, where does the South African government formally stand with regard to allying itself with the U.S. around this particular
issue? Well, the government as well has been, before the United Nations actually voted on this issue, was insistent that the United Nations approve both the reintroduction of the weapons inspectors and subsequently any punitive action against Iraq. President Mbeki, of course, is head of the Africa Union as well as the head of the Non-Aligned Movement, and in both those capacities has been very, very vocal in encouraging or discouraging the U.S. from acting unilaterally.
A lot of nations, we find, have found that it's not necessarily in their best economic interest to buck the U.S. in terms of partnering with it or allying with it or voting in favor of the U.S.'s resolutions in these major bodies. Does South Africa fall into that category as well?
Well, South Africa acquires a certain degree of immunity. One member of the U.S. State Department said to me once that South Africa punches above its weight. So it has, by virtue of its relative economic wealth and its principled stand stemming from its liberation struggle, a certain immunity from that. But you can see in other parts of the continent this either you're with me or against me standard that President Bush has laid out, an unwillingness by a number of African weaker African governments to even diplomatically challenge some of this.
In much of the national and international dialogue, we don't hear too much about the environmental impact that a war with Iraq might actually have. What about from your perspective, from the South African perspective?
There would be an immediate environmental impact, of course, in the Persian Gulf in terms of the damage done there to infrastructure, to rivers, to dams, to people, in terms of unexploded ordnance. You may recall in the Persian Gulf War, Saddam Hussein turned on the spigots, if you will, in Kuwait and released tremendous amounts of oil into the Persian Gulf. And so you can imagine that something similar, if not worse, would happen there. But there's a spillout effect. I mean, part of the realignment that President Bush seeks to realize, it's at least in Africa, is to become or draw closer to the U.S., the oil-producing states in Africa, primarily for that reason, to benefit from the oil, given the turmoil in the Persian Gulf. And so in countries like Angola and Nigeria and Cameroon and Gabon, countries and Sao Tome Principe, a small oil-producing nation just off the west coast, you will have, I think, an environmental fallout as a result of the increased production that the U.S. clearly expects from those countries.
What kind of fallout?
Well, you know, just off the coast of Spain, we've had their coastline bespoiled by this tremendous leakage from this tanker that sank. And so, obviously, those kinds of things would increase. If you look at Nigeria in its oil-producing regions, everything from toxic fumes from the refineries to environmental devastation of whole areas in terms of rivers and wetlands and residential areas, I think is the kind of thing that you can see multiplied in the oil-producing countries.
As a journalist who is following environmental issues, what kind of headlines might you imagine coming following an attack on Iraq?
Well, I think the apparently imminent war on Iraq provides more fertile ground in certainly many places in Africa for enemies of the United States. You may recall in South Africa that one of the men arrested for involvement in the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Tanzania was arrested in South Africa. There is now a suspicion that South Africa, because of its relative wealth and freedoms, is serving as a point for Al-Qaeda operatives to launder money, to acquire and exchange commodities like gold and diamonds, which are easier to move and more difficult to trace than cash. And so I think the overall environment will become more hostile to the United States in much of Africa, and to see it evolving in a place like South Africa, which has for so long been so friendly and admired the United States, is deeply troubling.
Is there any kind of anti-war movement actually afoot in South Africa?
There are demonstrations. There are protests, as you see, growing worldwide against the U.S. apparent intentions in Iraq. Many of these demonstrations also have a heavy component of opposing U.S. policy in the Middle East, as well as Israeli activities there.
Kenneth Walker, executive producer of Earth Rights. Walker says the U.S. policies in the Middle East provide fertile ground for enemies of the United States. Pre-nuclear war blues, a message to the world from songwriter-musician Mandrill.
Listen up, yeah. Went down by the river where the cold wind blow.
Wind blowing.
Up jump a fish about 100 years old. I said, fish. Whoa, Mr. Fish. I said, fish. Mr. Fish. He said, yes. What can I do for you? Yes, sir. What can I do for you? I said, my world in trouble. Give me some advice.
Tell me something good.
Evil destruction. You know that ain't nice. Armies are gathering in the Middle East. Everybody fidgety. Got that pre-war disease. They got the media talking stuff. The major world powers are joining up, surrounding a nation who
who control the crude? You know the thing is black and sticky. What we gonna do? What we gonna do? I want to know what we gonna do. Tell me what we gonna do. The fish just shook his head and turned around and said, yeah, humans are so stupid, I'm telling no lie. You mess up my ocean, kill my babies, now you're scared to die. You're the people of the planet, but you chose to live high fly. So put your head between your legs and kiss your ass goodbye.
Dr. Rick Wilson of Mandrill, he will be an upcoming guest on Peace Watch. On any given day, if you're lucky, you might see a tall man with a guitar singing and making up rhymes of current issues on the spot. Whether on the campus of the University of Washington, coffee houses, or concert halls, Jim Page carries on the tradition of Woody Guthrie, speaking out about current events. Issues like the logging industry or Bill Gates' software monopoly fill his songs. Taking his inspiration from blues greats such as Lightning Hopkins and Leadbelly, Page has been telling his stories of life for several decades. Today, he spoke to Peace Watch about the blues and America's reaction to the bombing on September 11th.
See, what the blues does, is the way I understand it. Now, I was into the country blues, which is, you know, acoustic guitars and stuff, and the old Lightning Hopkins, the old Johnny Hooker, that sort of thing. And what the blues does, to me anyway, is it dissolves the wall between you and the world. You use the music to speak to the world, and you tell the story of what you're involved in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nakedness and a reality there. Okay, now you don't have to use just those three chords. You can use whatever chord you want, and you can sing about whatever you want. But if you use that nakedness and that reality and that communication, direct, immediate communication, that's a big lesson to the blues. A lot of that I got from that old stuff. A lot of the songs that I write, actually, believe it or not, I strive for the kind of simplicity and directness
mm-hmm.
that you would find in, like, the Midnight Special, which is a song often attributed to Leadbelly. I don't know if it's his or whether it came from the Texas prison system. I think that's more likely. But it just has this wonderful simplicity, and it's just talking directly to you, and it's majestic, and it's gritty, and it's just everything that a song should actually be, in my mind.
I was thinking that even though you don't describe your music as the blues, you do touch on some political topics that are giving a lot of us the blues. The World Trade Center disasters, uh-huh. Collateral Damage is the title of one of your pieces. Uh-huh. Another one, Who Are They and Why Do They Hate Us?
Uh-huh.
Why do they hate us?
Well, that's, you know, I'm just one person. All I can tell you is what I think. You'd probably have to ask them. And
what's in your song?
Well, have you heard it?
No.
Okay, well, it was the first song I wrote after September 11th, and it was about 3 weeks later, something like that. Usually, I tend to have a gestation period of 3 to 4 weeks for some weird reason.
Mm-hmm.
But the question that was going around from the Americans to the world was, who are they and why do they hate us?
Of course.
And in certain circles, that's called playing dumb. So, okay, so playing dumb, so that's what we're doing right now. So I personally believe that most people are good, okay? I like people. I think people are great. I think there's a minority of sociopaths who are messing this whole thing up for the rest of us, right? But the majority of people are fine. Now, you take a perfectly good person, you make them overly busy, you burden them with debts, you make them drive on the freeway every day, you make them have to pay insurance rates and medical for the kids and blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, they're going to get weary. And they're going to want to come home from work and just watch the football game, right?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make them bad people. So the song is basically from the point of view of someone like that, who throughout the course of the years has seen the clues, has gotten bits of information from the TV news and from the newspapers and so on, but hasn't really put them together. There are things that have bothered him or her. Like there's a verse where the person says, my neighbor, she's a foreigner. I can't pronounce her name. When she talks about her homeland, her face fills with pain. She says she lost her children when the missiles hit. I don't know what to say, so I just change the subject. You see, he's noticed that when she talks about, and the listener assumes that this is a person from the Middle Eastern part of the world, You would assume that, not necessarily, but you would assume that. And when this person whose name this, you know, the singer can't even pronounce, speaks about where she came from, her face is painted and her children were killed by the missiles, and you're left to wonder if maybe those missiles weren't paid for by America somehow, because this guy's noticed it, and the contradictions bother him. He's never really grappled with it, but they've always bothered him, and I think a lot of people are like that. They've seen the contradictions, they've always bothered them, but they haven't had the time or whatever, the support system, to really grapple with it. Because if you really grapple with it, you're going to see a pattern, and the pattern is going to make you have to do something. And it's the having to do something which is the scariest, especially in the days of the Patriot Act and so on and so on. Having to do something could mean you lose your job, you lose your friends, you become isolated, people make fools of you, so on and so on and so on. And without a support system, that can be really scary. Anyway, that's that song.
Who are they? And why do they hate us? Well, I was raised to believe in this American dream, all the greatness and glory, the way that it seemed, how God was on our side and God doesn't lie. So why do all these innocent people have to die? Who are they? And why do they hate us? Every color in the cloth has a history to tell. Ships across the ocean and the Liberty Bell. Heroes in the monuments, I know them by name, but now their granite jaws are shattered and their eyes are full of rain. My neighbor, she's a foreigner, I can't pronounce her name. When she talks about her homeland, her face fills with pain. She says she lost her children when the missiles hit. I don't know what to say, so I just change the subject. Who are they? And why do they hate us? I see the TV news and they're burning my flag in some faraway land where it's just another rag. The looks on their faces, they make me freeze. How in the world did we make so many enemies? Who are they? And why do they hate us?
Songwriter, activist, guitarist Jim Page, his song Who Are They and Why Do They Hate Us from his CD Collateral Damage. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett, Jessica Kamen, and Bente Berklin. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.
Faraway country is somebody's home. Empires rise and empires fall. The world is big enough, there should be room for us all. Who are they? And why do they hate us?